The business of culture, the culture of business, creatives, media and entertainment, misfits, iconoclasts, so much more. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad.
The only bad advice in your struggle would be to be passive and not actively try to find a solution. I promise you, if you try to take some risky decisions, try to iterate, try to move around, you will find something that connects with you. The odds are in your favor, the math is in your favor, and the experience of millions of other people is in your favor. If you're moving around trying to navigate, you will find a way that works for you.
Here with the backstory of MBA-ish, the massive social media phenomenon that's been kind of part satire, part therapy, for the so many unhappy and existentially questioning management consultants, investment bankers, VCs, junior bankers. So much to learn here, especially in how MBA-ish is pivoting to an actual mentorship business. Do stay with us. This episode is made possible by the support of Salomon & Ludwin, a boutique wealth management firm dedicated to helping families make smart financial decisions. You worked hard and sacrificed to create and build wealth. They treat advice given to you with the respect your journey deserves. For over 30 years, Salomon & Ludwin has earned a reputation of trust and confidence, recognized by Barron's as a Hall of Fame advisor. More at salomonludwin.com. Full Disclosure Podcast to NPR, Spotify, and of course, Apple Podcasts. The link is fulldradio.com. You can follow on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at handle fulldradio. And a shout out to our listeners on WVTF Radio IQ, Virginia's NPR news station. You can DM me to carry Full Disclosure on your air. Joining me from Canada, specifically Toronto, the land of what? Rush and Tim Hortons? And what about the voice of Geddy Lee and Brian Adams and everybody else? It's Adil Van. He's the founder of MBA-ish. This is another one of these phenoms on Insta and TikTok. You have about 500,000 followers. You're a former management consultant, startup CEO, product leader, whatever you guys want to call it, private equity ninja. That I love this. I always tag you because you get at the existential angst of, you know, the spreadsheet class, the PowerPoint class. And now this is an actual business. So welcome to Full Disclosure. I wanted to learn all about it.
Thank you for that introduction. It was, a little too corporate-y because I don't really have another introduction yet for this particular thing. I have to come up with a better introduction for MBA-ish. But thank you very much. I know you've been following us for a while, and I know you love our corporate translations. You share it. You tag us into it. And I'm happy to be here.
Well, we talked about the generational divide as you and I were doing a mic check early on. I'm Gen X, firmly Gen X. I was born in the mid-70s. You were born in the mid-80s. Something very different about it. Here you are giving Wall Street advice, doing Wall Street and management consulting, hand-holding. No offense to anybody. I love that you're comfortable in your skin. For posterity and for the people listening to this on audio, the man has a man bun. That is incredible. That's incredible. The fact that you could do that, it's almost like it's almost telegraphing that I am so comfortable and accomplished that I can get away with doing this. It's like the person with the whiskey mustache that walks into a bar or something like that's the guy who wears a pants in his relationship. Tell us your backstory, how you got here, how you built this.
Sure. I mean, I would say first, my personality is in my yellow glasses, not my man bun. I would like to point that out. We're having yellow glasses here with a pink sweater and a man bun. So that's what I'm rocking right now. The story is fairly simple. I started my career in consulting. This is 2008, 2009, during the crisis in New York and the subprime mortgage era. Then I did my startup, and after that, I did some product stuff. And what became very clear in those experiences was how incredibly miserable and fake people are in the corporate world. And if you want to navigate that maze of the startup world, the corporate world, there is a certain amount of humor you have to have, because otherwise you cannot survive. There's a certain amount of empathy, a certain amount of confidence you got to have to be able to get through it. So this is 2017. I'm just fast forwarding here for you. It's 2017, and I am thinking about my next startup, and my goal very much was that I want to go into the content space because I can't write software, and I didn't want to go into that space.
So you were a management consultant at the very outset.
That's correct. That was my first job.
Let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
I'm thinking back, and you saw that McKinsey spoof video. I don't know if it was SNL or something like. we're McKinsey. We only recruit from these several schools and everything. That's and John Oliver. I'm thinking back. I graduated in 1998. And look, we didn't know what to do. Like, it was pretty binary. You could go to law school, or back then there was a boom in both management consulting and investment banking. That's what everybody did. And if you didn't want to, you didn't know what you wanted to do when you grew up, you went. But why, one, I still will never understand why I was gravitationally pulled to the McKinsey and Wall Street worlds, and I ended up on Wall Street, and two, why they would want me. We've had John Byrne from Poets and Quants on before, and really from the content that you cover, wouldn't you be far better off as an investment banker, a brokerage, or a management consultant, like building a printing company, like an in-house company that just builds pitch books? Why do you have to go out and get all of these people with incredible college resumes and summers of accomplishments and internships to slap together pitch books?
100% agree with you. And it's something that now, as we've gotten older, we look back and realize we didn't have to take that path. But the problem that we have is, you know, this is for me, 2006, 2007, we're not given a lot of options. You've just graduated your high school, right? Your entire world is in a very different place. Then you come into university, you're dealing with career counselors who are confused. You're dealing with professors who are, you know, focusing on 3-4 subject areas. Like, I started in accounting because in my circle, chartered accountant was like the thing to do. And I went all the way to third year and I was doing really well. And I realized I don't want to be a gap enforcer corporate police officer. So I had no idea what I was going to do. I left it. I just found a friend of mine one day and he was working at McKinsey. And he said, listen, there's this thing called management consulting. Okay. You get paid pretty good. It's prestigious. You get to travel. Now, for somebody who's 20 years old, who hasn't learned a whole lot in life, you're like, well, I'm looking for a job. And if they're asking for good marks and extracurricular, I've got that. So let me go here. Like, your worldview is very, very narrow at that time. And, you know, if you remember, I think for you, you may have seen this. For me, there was a little bit of a tech hype at that time, right? And I can't really code, so I'm not going to do anything. So for you, you're like, well, where am I going to go? Where am I going to make money and pay off my debts and stuff? So it was the lack of options. And we chose one that we thought was going to be glamorous. Look, listen, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, you're watching some of these shows, just the glamour of office and suits, it appeals to you. It's a whole different world. It's when you enter into it. Like, the first meme that I ever, you know, discussed on Facebook, this is 2009 now, I'm working at the firm. And I said to all my friends, you know, we're all just doing really mundane things in this very prestigious job. Like, there's nothing prestigious about this. We didn't know that at that time. So that's one of the reasons why you get drawn to it, is the allure. It's the fact that it's prestigious. Not everybody get into it. And then very quickly for me, within 2 years, I realized I don't want to be creating PowerPoint decks and, you know, spreadsheet models. I want to create companies and products. And that's when I started my own startup with my cousin. And the story changed after that. But I would say this, you know, there is a lot of benefit in going into some of these firms just because you learn how insane the world is. And how it works, okay? You're working at some of the best companies in the world, and this is how they operate. It gives you a sense of confidence to say, I can do better than that. This is not really that complicated.
And or it can depress the hell out of you and say,
this definitely depresses the hell out of you.
This is it.
It definitely does.
We had,
it definitely
there's
does.
A comedian, yeah. Go back and listen to him. He played, he was in the HBO series Silicon Valley, Jimmy O Yang. I didn't really, you know, we got him on the show because I found out, I think he worked at Smith Barney back in the day. You know, he's an immigrant from Hong Kong and his father's dream was for him to become an investment banker. And he's like, this job is literally killing me. If I don't get out of this seat, I'm going to die at this thing. Even if with the golden handcuffs and the equity they promised me and bonus season, if I don't go out there. And the flip side of that was him gigging at comedy clubs in Southern California for fish and chips and bartering with doormen and splitting a one bedroom with 5 people. But he pursued something soulful, and now he's a multimillionaire.
Agreed.
And he sells out shows on Comedy Central. What is it about that first job and the, and again, a lot of this is autobiographical, semi-biographical. You learn much more what you don't want to do than what you do want to do.
Absolutely. You realize that this is a lane that is definitely not connecting with me for whatever reason. And I think majority of the reason is, like, the reason why I left it is because before I had joined the consulting world, I had a small business of my own. I had a not-for-profit that I was running. And that was incredibly meaningful to me. Like, building something from zero to one was something that, you know, once you get a hook, once you get a hang of it and you go to the corporate world and you realize that I'm just not being utilized. Like, that was my biggest issue that I had, where I could be going in and having far bigger, more important strategic conversations, and I'm sitting here updating decks. And so for everybody else, the story of why I don't want to be here is different. Mine was, I can do way better than be here. And so I left for my startup. I have other friends who said, I can do way better in not-for-profit, or I can do way better in some other space. But I would say this, you know, if you're thinking of your career over a span of 40 years, okay, and then you die, but 40 years, let's think about that. After that, who knows what's going to happen. It is a very smart step to take, where if you can get a brand name on your resume, it does open doors. Like, till today, I get recruited for positions for Fortune 500 companies. And when I talk to recruiters and ask them, well, what is it that, you know, gravitated you towards me? And they will always point back to, well, you were a consultant and then you had a startup, and that's a very good combination, right? So, and I know people who are far more accomplished than I am in many ways, and they don't get those calls because they don't have the resume. So the unfortunate thing about, you know, the career world life is, those things do matter in the long term. And so my, you know, middle ground to recent grads is, first of all, go into tech if you can. Not only is it good money, but you learn a lot more about building things that are actually useful, right? There's a lot more meaning in building products than there is in building decks. And if you can't, then you go into consulting, banking, wherever. Go there for 2 years. It's going to be hard. Go with the mindset of, this is going to be challenging, and then get out. Don't get hooked to it. So what people do is they get hooked to that lifestyle. They go get hooked to that money, the Rolexes, the travel, and then it's very difficult for them to get out. And what I've helped, what I've done myself, and what I've helped my friends with is, how do you get out of that? Yes, it's going to be a bit of an adjustment, but life becomes so much better, and you got a pretty big name and some decent experience at this outset of your career, which I think is pretty important, as much as I hate to agree.
Adil, what I struggle with, and we've had the co-authors of the book Grit on. I've listened to Scott Galloway, Professor Galloway. He's been interviewed by me on Bloomberg TV. There's a whole school of thought, including, you know, immigrant parents that say, stick with it, suck it up, take the lumps. This is far better than working in a factory. It's far better than getting conscripted, you know, into Vietnam or these other places. I had an editor at Smart Money Magazine, the late Jersey Gilbert. He passed away. And one of his first jobs was working in, I think, one of the port cities outside of New Jersey, Bayonne or something. Somebody would pay him, a salad oil distributor, to go and step up in the tanks and dip his hand in and make sure that it was actually salad oil. And they didn't adulterate it with water. And then maybe he would clear $4 an hour doing this. Like, he can afford a hot dog in Coney Island once a week. And right. And this is a person kind of my generation. He grows up and he's this is well before the bull markets, well before, you know, the 1980s and stuff. And that taught grit. That taught perseverance. There were people who thinking about, do we hold off on buying new clothes during the crash of 87? There's something to be said. Yeah. About hardship and suffering. You know, there's that Offspring song. What is it? The more you suffer, the more it shows you really care. Talk to me about that.
You know, I think you mentioned this point just a little bit earlier too. I think that the idea that you can go and find some of these jobs and be lucky enough to make it somewhere, whether it's, you know, being a salad dressing oil tester or starting a printing job business or whatever the case is, at that age, you're just not mature or informed enough to take that risk. That's really the issue. Those who could, they did it. They did it, like, in our generation or my generation, the big thing was YouTube creators. So there were people who went into being YouTube creators and they made something out of it, or some, you know, who went into tech and made something out of it. But that option, unfortunately, is not one that's open to a lot of people. It's not that simple or easy to say. In retrospect, you can say he went here and then, you know, he was able to make a business out of it. But when you're standing at the precipice of that choice, you're going to take the easy way out, potentially the easy way out. You're going to take a risk, and then you'll figure out, you know, whatever issues come forth. And the immigrant point is very, very valid, because my parents are immigrants, and they're a bit more open-minded about where I wanted to pursue, although they were very, politely pushing me into chartered accountancy. But their idea was that they grew up in post-colonial era, India, Pakistan, the Middle East.
Yeah.
And in that time, the economy was a very weak economy, where lawyers, doctors, chartered accountants, and others were the only safe bets that they had. And they've seen poverty. So you got to, for me, I always respect their opinion and say, okay, I do get it that you went through these difficulties. But it's not the same here. But the economy is so diverse. There are so many ways to make money that you can actually choose a different path. Like, my dad still can't believe that I'm making a business out of memes. Like, to him, it doesn't compute. And it's not just that. It's people who are my generation, who are my friends, or even my followers. They can't understand that you can build a business out of a meme. But because the economy is so mature and so diverse and deep, that you can make that happen.
Let me share that disconnect for you generationally. I was born in Iran. My late father is a doctor, and the parents, the immigrants who come to this country, we risked everything for you, you know, stay in school, drink milk and everything. But the odd lot, you know, distant Iranian relative in Irangelis that, you know, finds out I'm a journalist, I'm a particular a freak to them. Like, they'll pull me aside when I'm out there and they'll say, Farzad, journalism, does it pay commission? And I say, no, why you are doing, why? Does it pay? I go, well, I mean, it pays psychically. I enjoy doing it. I get to interview interesting people and fly to places. And then they look back. They're like, okay. They take a sip of tea. Why you don't go open a gas station? That was a very different kind of old money, new money, immigrant money coming here. And I'm thinking about that pressure. And I'm thinking about the pressure that made me go off to an Ivy League school. And I didn't know afterwards, where do you want to go? I'm not going to medical school. I'm not going to law school. Anyway, I want to get to one of the memes you cited, an NBA-ish, on your Instagram account, which has about 500,000 followers. I love it. You know, I consume it every day. The title is How My Boss, Quote, Collaborates With Me. You have this circle. The boss asked me to solve a problem I understand deeply. The boss rejects my solution. Boss insists on their crappy solution. I execute the solution. It fails spectacularly. Boss pivots to my solution. It works. He takes credit. It's something we all know too well. And I'd love to ask you about this in the environment where it seems like the leverage is now with the workers. I think even in the white collar class, you saw what happened with the Goldman investment bankers during the pandemic who kind of fought back. They released the PowerPoint memo like, we want to fight for our rights. You can't keep us in for 23 hours a day. And then half of the population was like, oh, you poor investment bankers making hundreds of thousands of dollars. And others were like, no, they have rights. This is correct. And suddenly work from home, as you notice, and you guys cover this quite a bit. You have all of these execs out there saying that this is the way we work collaboratively. This is the way work happens, even though many of these very same firms have had record productivity and profitability during that period.
That's right. I mean, look, this is the bad news, okay? Workers had leverage from 2020 till 2022 and a half. The moment the economy started tanking, this is late 2022, October onwards, the crypto bust happened and the VC bust happened and SBF bust happened.
Sam Bankman-Fried.
Sam Bankman-Fried happened. Ever since then, slowly, and it's accelerated in the last quarter, the power is firmly in the hands of leadership again. It's actually not in the hands of workers anymore. And you can see that in the evidence of the forced return to office directives that are being given out, the massive layoffs that are taking place, the redundancies that are taking place because of AI. People, you know, I have a lot of conversations in DMs, people saying, look, I don't really have another option right now because the job market is tough. It's become so insane now.
Well, back up. There was a slew of tech layoffs. A bunch of the technology firms realized that they'd overextended. The largest ones in the world. There was Google, Meta, Facebook did it. Microsoft scaled back, and then they got to harvest those gains of productivity with bumper crop profits last year into the AI boom. And then they realized, all right, we don't have to be as fat as we were maybe in 21 and 22. But this has forced the loss of clout by a lot of unemployed people.
Correct. Exactly. So now when you go to the job market, it's a lot more competitive. And it's not just that the employee or the employers have realized that there's a lot of talent. So now, you know, my favorite topic comes into play. The insanity of recruiting has gone to the next level. 8 rounds, 9 rounds of interviews, people being left, you know, midway through the interviews because employers and leaders have realized that it's now a buyer's market. It's not a labor market anymore. So I just wanted to make that point that you mentioned. About collaboration, listen, my theory is very simple on this, and it's that executives don't know how to manage, how to build culture when people are not in the same office. And instead of saying, hey, we should actually adopt and we should adjust just like they ask us to do in every other situation of ours, they've decided that no, squarely, I want people inside the office for X, Y, Z reason. And there's a famous article that came out by from Business Insider, I think a year ago, and it cited reasons why the senior leadership wanted people back inside the office. Now, there's this one lying narrative, which is completely false, it's propaganda, that it's about productivity. It's not about productivity at all. I think it's one of the weakest excuses that you can provide, because the evidence that you mentioned earlier has been clear during pandemic, during work from home, record profits and so forth. But the reasons that were cited by the leadership were insane. One leader said something like, well, I really enjoy seeing a full parking lot when I come into the office. Who cares? Or I really love seeing people, you know, at the water cooler having a conversation. Again, who cares? That has nothing to do with what you're doing. Or I love seeing people in the office having fun and, you know, walking by my office. And I'm like, but that office is always closed. It's never really open. There's nothing happening here, right? So leadership, for whatever reason, has decided I want people in the office because it allows me to give, you know, greater control. I don't know if that's just culturally, whatever the case is. But it has led to a very, you know, difficult environment for collaboration. You cited the collaboration meme. It's happening more and more. I think with work from home, it was a little bit of a different collaboration. I think that, you know, what I heard from people was that there was less micromanaging happening and there was more effective work going on. But now that people have you in the office, that circle that you just mentioned, that cycle of collaboration, has become once again entrenched with, let's just do what I want to do and I'll take the credit for it.
I want to share one of the memes. I don't know if anybody could see it here. It's on collaboration at the office on MBA-ish. It says, the headline is Return to Office Collaboration. And you have a bunch of, you know, clip art at an office pantry. I'm almost done my coffee. Anyone want to grab another one?
Exactly.
You know, did you see that recent one from Internet Brands with the CEO and the other executives coming out to a song saying, we're not asking, we're telling you to come back. And it leaked and it repelled back against them because they didn't even record it at the office. You could see that it was done as a blue screen.
My goodness.
You could see that the other executives, it looked like they were reading a hostage statement. And I'm thinking to myself, gosh, it's one thing for this to happen in a sub 4% unemployment rate, at least here in the United States. And with white collar, it must be even lower. But what if the unemployment rate was closer to 2008, 2009, when you kind of had your coming of age? Then I think a lot more fear would motivate people to go back to the office. Like, I got to covet the job that I did get.
I think you're seeing that fear already because a lot of people don't remember what happened in 2008. This is their 2008 from what they can tell. So the fear response hasn't changed. People are going back. And what you mentioned, I've seen a video, I'm not sure if it's the same one, but it's the brazenness of these conversations now. And that's why I say the, you know, power dynamic has shifted towards the leadership. And it's going to take another 18 months for it to balance out. But the brazenness of it is really disgusting to watch, you know, especially for those employees that are watching these videos. It's very clear. And, you know, in the DMs I've been hearing over the last 3 months, how the town halls have become much, much more clearer about what they're doing. First of all, you're not allowed to ask questions anonymously anymore, because that would unfortunately put leadership into a very sensitive position of having to answer difficult questions that they've never been had to answer because it's surrounded by yes men or yes women. But people are just being told, you're coming here, and if you're not, here are the consequences. And I think there's also something a little bit more nefarious, which is that people do want to shed, or leadership does want to shed some of this fat by, you know, voluntary exits, where people are like, I'm not coming in, I might as well go somewhere else. And that's happened as well. I know I have friends at Amazon and other companies.
I hate the euphemism slapped on that is managing people out. That's like right out of office
staff
space.
Augmentation, you know,
culling the herd,
resizing. There's like a whole, I think there's like 15, 20 different words that are being used because they're not courageous enough to come out and say, I made a mistake and we have to let people go. It's like their family that we're now, you know, getting away from. It's a limb of ours that we have to sacrifice. No, it's not. Just keep it simple.
Full disclosure, do stay with us. Full Disclosure podcast to NPR, Spotify, all the podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts. The link, everything's all there, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. We are on all the socials, I'm talking Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Friendster, Napster, Huckster, you name it. The handle is Full D Radio and my DMs are open. And look out for big honking live shows in 2024. I am talking to rocker Pete Yorn. We're probably going to have Abigail Spanberger, gubernatorial candidate in Virginia, on. So many big names coming up. Do follow at handle Full D Radio on all the socials. If you are just joining us, my guest is Adil Vaid, founder of MBA-ish. This is the phenom on Instagram, at the very least. I know you're on TikTok. You're a former management consultant, startup CEO, product leader. I called it spreadsheet monkey. Well, after I realized what I was doing, is that okay? I mean, you know.
I mean, I would like to say that I evolved from spreadsheet monkey to, VC funding chasing monkey to user experience monkey. The monkey doesn't change. It just evolves into different things. So I'm still, and now I'm a meme monkey. So we'll see how it goes. But at the end of the day, after a little while, you just realize that some of this stuff is just mundane and you got to get through it.
You know, I went to business school with someone who became a star executive at one of the biggest tech companies in the country. I'll try to maintain the anonymity. But he had a story from McKinsey. I'll never forget this because I can't believe it actually happened to him. He was staffed by McKinsey somewhere, in the mid-Atlantic somewhere. And the best hotel he could stay at near the client or one of the client's foundries or factories was, Holiday Inn Express. And he was hungry after a whole day of being with the client. And there was nothing in the hotel. There wasn't even a mini bar. But someone at the hotel told him you could walk up to the truck stop a half a mile up on the interstate. And he did. And I'll never forget him telling me this story. The truck stop did not leave the doors open at night. The people were very afraid of armed robbery. So he had to go to the front window and say, food. He had to point at the back, like loaf of bread, like can of peanut butter and everything. And so what did his McKinsey, corporate card? Yes. That didn't do anything. And so they got that and they squeezed it through the thing. And he's there thinking, it's 30 degrees. I'm a top grad. I got this golden, a bronze ring job and everything. And he's like scraping peanut butter and eating it. And so he's walking back on the interstate, some rain hitting his face. And then these wild dogs start chasing him. And then he's jumping over the median and trying to throw bread to keep the wild dogs off of his chase. And that was the point that he told me. And I think this is a couple of beers we had in business school. He's like, I had to get out of this job. I mean, I understand that it was prestigious. Mom and dad could tell everybody I worked for McKinsey. Maybe it was going to get me a job at IBM or in the corporate suite. But I was a grunt, and this is not what I wanted to do in my 20s. What was your similar inflection moment, at least with satire and coping with this? You knew that you had more to give, but was there an incident, an event, a realization where you're like, this has to be parodied?
First of all, I think that story made me remember that he was acting or he was experiencing more of Oliver Twist, Sir, Can I Have More Soup, than he was McKinsey, poor guy. I think... The most enjoyable moments of parody for us have come from our town hall meetings. Like, town hall is the most magical corporate fairy tale place in the world, where you go in and you listen to executives say things that you know are absolutely not true. They'll show graphs and they'll say, we're beating the competition, or we're class this and that, and product people, marketing people in the back are saying, that's bullshit, that's actually not true at all. So a lot of our, or a lot of the, corporate speak parody that we do comes from town halls. Like, one of the most insane words that I heard to describe a low talent workforce was that we have low talent density. And I was like, that is bullshit. That needs to be parodied. There were those. But, for me, like, the biggest moment where I, it wasn't a fed up moment, but the biggest moment that I realized that I'm going to go into this meme space was when I was working at a startup. This is 2018 now, and I'm working, this is a B2B startup. You have a lot of inside salespeople selling products. Great, excellent. I love salespeople. Their lives are very difficult, jobs are very difficult, okay? But as the product lead, I have to communicate to them on what they can and cannot say about the product, what is true and what is not true. So I'm sending out these emails, very well-structured emails. I'm priding my ability to communicate, all that stuff. But it's not getting through. It's getting very frustrating. They're repeating the same things that they're not supposed to be repeating. And I'm trying to figure out, what do I do to connect with them? And so I decided, this is 2018 now, that I'm going to send memes. And I'm going to communicate to them only in memes. Back in the days, in 2018, memes were very basic. You had your SpongeBob meme, the, you know, confused penguin meme.
So I understand memes over corporate messenger or Slack. Over, because they're always compliance
email
issues.
Distribution list over a wide email distribution list. So I started sending these. So I sent this one email out. It had four or five different memes, and each meme communicated a point about the product. And, you know, after sending in 10 minutes, I started hearing these laughters from the sales floor, and people coming in and they're, you know, giving me high fives and fisting, bumping fists. And that's when I realized this meme thing is something that is so incredibly powerful in the corporate world because it breaks the tension and helps you communicate. That's really the origin story of MBA-ish. But it came at a time when I was really getting tired of communicating with different people in the workplace and realizing and not realizing that people are stressed. They don't want to see another dense email, regardless of how well it's structured, because they have so many of those. Anyways, that's really where the meme inspiration came, and that's where it led to MBA-ish eventually. And I'm very happy for those salespeople till today. Thank you very much for not listening to me, because it led me to a different path.
It goes without saying that wherever you work, the machine that's not on compliance is your smartphone. You have this massive camcorder, recorder, microphone, powerful computer, more powerful than one of the, you know, ones that powered the first the shuttles to go off to the moon or something like that, or the rockets. And that is your way of opting out. It's not on the company's network. It's not on the VPN. Clearly, you can do things or step outside the building and vent and share memes and share text. Tell me about that as kind of a foot in the door.
When I started this memes journey, because of that smartphone, I was, you know, secretly writing some of this stuff down during my meetings and engaging with my followers during my meetings as a way to escape the insanity that I was dealing with at that time. But it's not entirely true. I think there are still companies who are very strict about their policies of the smartphone, and you know, you have to use their LAN network, and there's certain restrictions that come with it. But the opt-out that I have seen is more around DMs. That's where people really let go and have conversations. They're like, I just came out of this brutal meeting. I just want to rant. And I'm like, go ahead, you know, share your thoughts, share your ideas. And what I'm finding is before people would like and share and comment, but now once we've built enough of an audience and they've trusted me with the voice and trusted my team with the voice, they're actually coming in and they're venting to us in our DMs, in our stories, and telling us what's going on, helping us, asking us if there's ways to navigate. Or sometimes they would just start off by saying, listen, I just want to vent here. Can I vent? And I'm like, go ahead. And what we have realized from that experience is that memes have become a doorway to therapy. That's really what memes are. We are therapists. Internally, when we talk to our teams on our Slack, we realize we entered into the space for entertainment purposes, but this has now become mass therapy of 500,000 people engaging, discussing what issues.
You're so right. And I feel like I owe you a fat psych copay, because there's certain things in there. You see that I hit the like and I hit the share. I know I'm a bit Gen X player on your, you know, millennial playground of MBA-ish, but there's some things you say that I just want to, gosh, that make you think about mortality and wasted time and the absurdity out there, especially after becoming a father and thinking, I'm wasting my time acting like this, shaking my head at these all hands towns meeting, and knowing the shadow and persona of these people, and the memes just cut to that chase.
Yeah, it makes you feel like you're not alone. The message that we keep hearing over and over again is, you have made me feel like I'm not alone, or, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, you know, the thing that we didn't realize is that how people connect to these memes at a very deep emotional level. There is something so powerful in people just saying, listen, I wake up in the morning and I'm looking forward to your meme, because we post once in the morning, once in the night. Or I come from work and I'm going through your feed or going through your stories because I want to feel connected and validated that the things that I'm feeling right now are in fact insane. And yes, they are. They are indeed insane. And so we become therapists, and it's been very helpful. What's happened oftentimes is when you're having these conversations, it becomes therapy for you too, because you yourself realize, hey, even though, like for us, if you think about it, we're sitting behind a computer writing these memes and we put it out, right? But we don't really feel the emotional connection until somebody else comes back to us and says, this thing was so true or helped me in XYZ way. And that's when it hits us back, that we are all in this circle, really just insane, idiotic things that are happening. And mostly it's happening because And, you know, people don't have the courage or the understanding of how to navigate these issues, or somebody to stand up and say, why are we doing this? What is the reason behind it? And that lack of courage just leads into a vicious cycle of one situation over another just keeps getting worse and worse.
I certainly wish it was there when I went through my first performance review at the brokerage firm I worked for after college, which I was completely unfit for. I took it for peer pressure reasons. I remember when the managing partner looked at me and said, somebody in this 360 thing says smiles too much. Somebody actually dinged me for smiling too much.
That is, you know what? That is so true. That is so true. That kind of stuff, especially 360, is one of the things that really pisses me off, because most feedback is useless. Most feedback is about, like, corporate feedback is all about, we're making a video on this. Most corporate feedback is about, how do I make you the most blandest person possible? How do I emulate you into whatever the CEO thinks the person should be, into that thing, take away all personality, all thing from you, so you can come across as a very safe bet every single day? And so you hear these kind of things. Like, I've had feedback where people have said, you don't smile enough. I mean, look, I have a resting bitch face. Okay, that's just the way it is. I cannot go and force my smiles. Or I've had other people who've been given the review that, you know, you say sorry too much, even though that's not entirely true. And it becomes a place, a situation where people start calling out stuff they don't like about you just for their own personal preferences. And it has nothing to do with improving yourself professionally or the firm. And that kind of stuff really, you know, puts people into a very difficult situation of, how do I act?
And for the 20-something out there, for the impending quarter-life crisis person, I want to say, it's one, it's okay to be a misfit. It's going to get rewarded later in life. You'll find where you fit in and where you will assert yourself and where that will be appreciated. And two, your 20s are precious. You know, I had this sword of Damocles over me thinking, what are my classmates going to say? What are my parents going to say if I don't go to law school, if I don't go to business school, if I don't complete the 2 years at this brokerage firm, if I don't get put on associate and MD track? Truth is, nobody cares. You should use the time. And it's a time, it's cliche and very Fortune magazine to say failure is great. But if ever you're going to fall on your face, you're unencumbered by a family, by a wife, by mortgage, by all these things. And meanwhile, you know, you're brought up in the immigrant and the type A kind of, in my world, kind of the Ivy League circle to say, go, 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 go. And you have to benchmark against the various other, you know, summa cum laude people who've gone off to Harvard Law and everything. I know this is a therapy session for you, but what you do provide is a great escape, is a great community. It's great affirmation to see 500,000 people have signed on and opted into this and shared things in their DMs. You know, we had someone on when I was at Business Week years ago. There was a more kind of desktop version of this called the leveraged sellout. It was a guy named Amit Wadhwani on Wall Street. And you really captured this mode for kind of the mobile DM class. And I want to ask you, that was a long transition to say, when did this congeal into a thing that you had to actually get a couple of people around you and you had to be in stealth mode and you had to observe confidentiality? But this is not you alone kind of working on the side. Tell me about that.
It's a team of five people who all have similar backgrounds in terms of we're coming in from situations where we have to be, or we were pressured into doing, you know, very high sort of career things, and us realizing we're creative people, this isn't doing it, and we're all good at mentoring, so let's try to bring it together. So the origin story is really 2018, I'm thinking about how do I build my content startup. So it was very intentional in that sense. And at the same time, I was helping a lot of people, you know, at my level, my direct report, sometimes even C leadership, on how to navigate some insane issues that were happening in the workplace. And the feedback that I was getting was, this is really helpful. So in my mind, you have this thing sorting, okay, I have to find a way to help people deal with some of these issues. And I want to get in the content space. And then the crystallizing moment was that sales story of me sending memes and it really getting the reaction that it did. You know, that made me realize this is a combination that we can go forward with. And so the idea that I pitched to my other coworker who I'd worked with a few years back, I said, listen, corporate world is a big mess that people are trying to make sense of. You and I are pretty good with navigating these issues. And now we have this proof in using memes and little sort of bit of satire to connect with people. Let's make something out of it. So we actually tested some memes internally with senior leadership and others. And the reaction was pretty good. And so we said, okay, we're going to turn this into this account. We decided to call it MBA-ish. And we are going to start mentoring people using satire. And at that time, the first 3 months, it was a struggle because we realized people actually weren't willing to listen to just mentorship or advice. That wasn't what they wanted. What they really wanted, and like, you know, I would put out these testing memes that were salty, satirical, very brash. Those got shared a lot. So it became very clear that this is what people are looking for. And that's the moment when my partner and I said, okay, we're going to put the advice aside. We're going to do it in captions or in DMs, but let's go all into various nuanced issues that we face and let's talk about that. That's how it started. Then, you know, over the next 1 year, we brought in 3 other co-founders because what happened was as the account was growing, we had a lot of inquiries from sponsors and other people. And we realized we don't have time to work and do memes and do sponsorship conversation.
I know this is a little in the weeds, but when you become something like a several hundred thousand Instagram account, again, Instagram owned by Meta, very valuable younger eyeballs, right? Much more than linear TV, clearly newspapers or websites. Yeah. What are these overtures typically to you? Would you hold up like this tie? You know, is it Vineyard Vines or something? I mean, are there actual cash offers for you to go out and say, we want you to endorse these things?
So the way it worked for us is sponsors reached out to us. And they said, you know, we actually want to let your audience know of XYZ product. And you know, half the time would say, this actually doesn't fit our audience. You know, so we don't do anything to do with weights. You know, at that time, the big thing was sexual products online. I'm sure if you follow enough accounts, you would have seen enough of those ads. And we're like, this doesn't fit our audience. There are people who were willing to talk about crypto. We're like, we don't talk about crypto. There are others who talk about this kind of stuff. So we were very selective, but then they would come to us and they would say, how can we work together? And I would basically, you know, do some calculations and say, this is what our package looks like. This is what you will get, a post where we'll talk about this particular stuff. Here's a story where I'm going to endorse your product because I've used it. I like it. I'm going to build a narrative around it. So there's packages that we create and there's a conversation. And then there is cash, you know, exchange that takes place. And then we go out and we put their messages out and then we go back to them with detailed reports on how the campaigns did, what worked, what didn't work.
Adil, were you heavy-hearted when you were doing that? Because again, there was a hybrid kind of therapy hand-holding thing. And you look, the way it works for me, if I want a sponsor, look, I love RC Cola. I want to reach out to RC Cola and say, I want to shout your product from the rooftops, everything.
Yeah.
I'm not their demo. They don't sponsor anyway. They don't need me.
Right.
Some funky thing like Hims or a vaping product came to me and offered $10,000 an episode. I love this is my baby, this pod. I've been doing it for 10 years. I got to be so careful. I got to really practice what I, you know, preach what I practice.
Totally agree. That's why I would say we've probably said no to 60, 70% of the sponsors who wanted to work with us. We're like, this is not what we're doing. Our goal was very simple. You know, my belief is, it's not really anything deep or philosophical, products solve problems. It's that simple. So the approach that I took was this product of ours or of yours has to solve a problem for our audience. And so when I was doing these sponsorship posts or advertisements in our stories, I was pitching them as this is the pain that's going to go away or that's going to be reduced with this product. I have used it. I recommend it. So that's where, like, for me, it wasn't that difficult. The heavy-hearted part, you know, part was there were some financial companies that reached out and they offered a lot of money. Saying no to a lot of money because it wouldn't work with our very no bullshit conversation and I didn't know where it was going to take our customers in terms of benefit, turning those down were the difficult part. But the products that made sense for our following, it was a no-brainer. I'm helping you. This is what it's about.
Full disclosure, do stay with us. Full disclosure, I'm Robin Farzad. Our esteemed guest is Adil Vine. He is founder of MBA-ish. He's one of the partners who's recently unmasked. This is like Kiss in the early 1980s or something. They came on MTV and you could see Gene Simmons' face. He's a former management consultant, startup CEO, product ninja. MBA-ish has now accumulated, what, 500,000 followers on Instagram and, you know, TikTok as well. You're very big there.
No, we're actually getting into TikTok now because before we didn't have a face. So getting on TikTok really doesn't work if you don't have a face. So now that I have my face, We are now going to go very heavy on TikTok as soon as this masterclass week is over next Tuesday. Then we're going to go do a lot of our videos. We have a huge slate of satire that we've been waiting on for a year and a half, 2 years. We've been preparing for it, so I can't wait to get in that space and continue the memes on our Instagram account.
Here's what I don't get, and maybe it's the cynical side, and it's easy for me to do it as a journalist. But you, in the end, with your mentorship practice, you know, packages and best practices stuff, I saw the video that you had, like experiences learned or things learned or lessons learned as bullets to add to LinkedIn. What you're doing is enabling, like part of me like sees all this stuff and wants to burn it down and poke fun of it forever. But you're also enabling people to be better at these jobs or to get these jobs. So that's a split world.
Yeah, that's very astute. Listen, our business model is we're going to call out the bullshit with the memes, and then we're going to help you navigate that bullshit with mentorship and masterclasses. Because the reality is that we cannot escape, a lot of people cannot escape this situation. You potentially could, I could, but most people cannot be individual creators or business folks. So they have to find a way to navigate these situations. But really, what sort of brought us towards this end was, we're doing memes, and in our captions, we were also giving advice on how to navigate XYZ situation. And that got a lot of people saying, thank you, this actually helped me, this makes my life easy, right? And so it became very clear that, look, we are in the business of helping people navigate the issues they're seeing. Memes and satire is one way to make sense of what you're feeling. But mentorship and masterclasses is another way of educating on how to navigate. So that is something that we, you know, even if there was no business model around it, that's who we are. All five of us, the backgrounds that we have, we are satirical, we are salty, but we're also very good at helping people navigate these situations and really make work a better place. So my goal is we can teach a lot more people about this, and hopefully that trickles down to individual departments and offices, and it makes, you know, a workplace a little bit of a better place. I won't take a lot more credit for it, but it does make a difference.
Adil, in the 6 or 7 minutes we have left, I have to ask you the big megatrend question in this, and that AI is the big fat theme that came out of kind of that mid-2022 slowdown. And you see where NVIDIA is headed. You see Microsoft, OpenAI, ChatGPT, Midjourney. And I'm thinking back to my experience as a kind of a spreadsheet and PowerPoint monkey. And the 2-year analyst position at brokerage firms, which a lot of it has been automated out, and the management consultant role, how much of this is going to be threatened? I'm sure you're going to be asked at cocktail parties, or enhanced by AI. I mean, I can right now, I don't know, as an associate, conjure up a pitch book presentation. I can throw in kind of AI inputs, and Microsoft, which owns PowerPoint, right, and has an investment, what is it, in OpenAI, and is a significant investor in this, can, you know, the way it can conjure up templates and do stuff for me, the iteration can take a lot of this iteration out of the process that used to make the midnight investment banking monkey miserable. I mean, maybe it's good and it's bad. Talk to me.
I think there's, let's start with the consulting world first. The consulting world operates on the promise that we have some of the best minds in the world. They're available to you at any given time. And oh, by the way, they're right here. You can talk to them. That is the product that they're selling. Okay. And no amount of AI is going to reduce that. You will need people there. Unless clients start saying that I'm okay with low FaceTime and just giving me AI products, that's fine. I don't think clients will agree to that. They want human, you know, experience. They want that FaceTime with them. So as long as that's there, consultants' time may reduce in what they're doing with their PowerPoint stuff and spreadsheets, and their time may increase in FaceTime. They might, you know, it might get shifted, but I don't see the doom and gloom about the entire thing being automated happen. And there's another cynical reason for that. Inside companies in general, you need somebody to blame. It's that simple, okay? And the, you know, I have, so one of my partners leads a big team in one of these tech companies. We've talked about this. Nobody is willing at this point to say, I'm going to reduce my staff by 15% so that, you know, and use AI. Because when shit hits the fan, nobody's going to accept at the leadership level that it's AI that screwed it up. Do you understand? So there's a big fear that people have, if we go down in this direction without human intervention, that there might be some risk that we're going to be exposed to. So that's one aspect that I think is going to be a bit of a, you know, barrier or friction to adopting AI as freely as a lot of the, you know, writers would want you to believe. It's not that simple. There's a lot of politics and human emotions that are involved that will take time before AI comes into play, and I don't know how much it's going to replace us. But the second thing is that, you know, AI is not as efficient and effective as people like to believe. It still takes time. You still have to learn the prompting and the editing and the revising. So to say that somehow that's going to reduce or change the industry in significant ways, I'm not buying it yet. Maybe 4 or 5 years, I think something significant would have to happen. I mean, think about this example, right? Video calling, what we're doing here, Zoom calls, okay? It had to take an entire pandemic for that technology to be adopted at large scale, for that experience to happen. You know, one of my tweets that became viral in 2020 was, who led the digital transformation in your company? And the three options were CEO, CTO, and COVID-19, and then COVID-19 was circled, right? It took that much of a human experience for that wide of a digital adoption to happen. So AI, it has a lot of human inertia that it has to overcome. It's not going to be that simple. It might make things efficient, but right now what I'm hearing is it's taking more time to work with AI than to work with your shortcuts because you're so used to it.
Adil, in the 3 or so minutes I have left with you, this is speaking to kind of miserable 21, 22-year-old me. This is miserable you in the financial crisis. This is when the Venn diagrams of Gen X and Gen Y and everybody else connect. I want you to dig deep as a mentor, as a therapist, as a satirist, as a fellow creative. Is there one piece of overriding omnibus advice you could give to the scared imposter syndrome young 20-something who's in a misfit job? Who's in one of these positions that takes much solace and comfort and hits like, smashes like as much as possible on MBA-ish. But it's like, what do I do with this? Where do I take from this? Is this just a wrong detour in a cul-de-sac and I chalk it up to experience? Do you think about this? Is there something out there that you wish you could shout from the rooftops to sad 22-year-olds?
You know, I mean, there's quite a few things we can share, but what I'm going to say is this. As a human being, it's just a part of us that we adjust. And so, yes, things look very difficult right now. But what happens is, as you grow, you either become jaded. And those things that are problematic to you right now, they don't impact you as much. And two, you become a lot more mature about how to handle your situation. So this trial that you have, it teaches you more about how do I handle situations than anything else. So it's not that you're going to be in this perpetual state of confusion and misery. There will be different types of misery that will come through, but you actually become much better at learning to deal with it. Even if you don't try, it's just a human experience that you have. And the second thing I would say is that the only bad advice in your struggle would be to be passive and not actively try to find a solution. I promise you, if you try to take some risky decisions, try to iterate, try to move around, you will find something that connects with you. The odds are in your favor, the math is in your favor, and the experience of millions of other people is in your favor. If you're moving around trying to navigate, you will find a way that works for you.
Adil Van, founder, spiritual leader, chief therapist of MBA-ish. Give us all of your specifics. Again, for an analog Gen X guy, we can find you on Instagram at MBA-ish. You're starting up Correct. On TikTok. Tell us about the modules, about the mentoring.
So we have a masterclass. It's called the Corporate Translation Masterclass. And the goal is simple. It is to teach you how to stand out in your resumes, interviews, and performance reviews. Simple as that. And we do that by teaching you strategies on how to take your everyday mundane work and convert it into language and context that people understand. So one of the things that I've learned in this mentorship is a lot of people are doing some really interesting things. They just don't know how to talk about it. It's something that nobody teaches you. Like, let me give an example. If you have somebody who says, I increased revenue by 10%, that's pretty good. But if somebody says, I increased revenue by 10% during 2020 pandemic, when the industry revenue was down by 10%, the second person sounds far more impressive. So we're teaching you all these strategies on what language to speak that will connect with people who are making decisions on your career, whether it's hiring managers, team leaders, or others. And I think the best advice that we've gotten, or the best testimonial that we've gotten on this class, is that we're the corporate Rosetta Stone. That's what we're doing.
Adil Van, MBA-ish, consider yourself a friend of the show. I hope you come back on.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. This was great.
Full disclosure, special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham at Nottoli. While we often have to trim for broadcast link, the entirety of every episode, the extended interviews are available on podcast. The link, please subscribe, is fulldradio.com. Again, fulldradio.com. We are on the NPR One app, all of the fine podcatchers, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Special thanks to Claire Morgan and Case Graham with Nottoli. We are an NPR member station, WVTF, Radio IQ News, across the great Commonwealth. Holler if you too would like us on your air. And don't forget, I'm on NPR's Here and Now every week. I'm Robin Farzad. Thank you for listening. Back with you next week.